I'm Phil C.
And I'm Lynn.
And together,
we're Roman Oz.
Real interviews.
With real people.
On location.
With a great mix of Aussie music.
As requested by the people we interview.
Follow us on Facebook.
Or check us out. AllAussieRadio.com.au.
Now syndicated too.
Backwater Country. 87.6 FM.
Tuesdays and Fridays.
At 9 PM.
All interviews are live.
And on location.
And may vary in audio quality from segment to segment.
So, Phil, what's on the show this week?
Well, Lynn, we've only got two guests on the show today.
Right, yes.
Now, this is very unusual because normally it's me talking to all our guests, but you're kicking the show off today.
Yes, I am. We're in White Cliffs.
Yes.
And we're at the Southern Cross Opals, right. And I'm speaking to Dick Wagner.
Now, what a fascinating guy he is.
Yes, he was.
Absolutely. Yes. What a wealth of information all about opals and also a little bit about the history of the place too. And straight after that, Lynn?
We're in Narromine,
right.
Back to the Aviation Museum.
Yes. Part two with Mr. Peter Kirath.
Yes, that's correct.
Talk underwater with a mouthful of marbles,
just
Peter
like
Kirath. Because there was so much to talk about last week, we couldn't possibly fit him in just one show.
No, and it is an interesting place.
Look,
and there's so much history.
It is. It's a fascinating place. And I must say, you know, Peter was such a wonderful man to chat to.
He was, yes.
So we thought we're not going to cut him off short.
Very good.
Before we do those two interviews, though,
right.
I'd like to play a song right at the start. We don't often do this.
No, we don't. It's very rare.
I've selected a song by John Williamson, and it's all about opal mining.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, not White Cliffs?
No, because I couldn't find one for White Cliffs except the White Cliffs of Dover.
Not suitable.
Vera Lynn, pre-war classic.
Yeah.
Can't go there.
No.
So the one I've selected is a number called Lightning Ridge, because Lightning Ridge, as you know, is an opal field as well.
That's correct.
It's an opal town. What a fabulous place it is.
As well as Cooper Pedy.
It is. Well, they're worlds apart, though. Lightning Ridge is like cosmopolitan. And Cooper Pedy's very dusty.
Yes, but so is White Cliffs.
Just like White Cliffs, okay? So I'm going to start off with that song, and then you and I are going to tell the listeners a little bit about the town and the area of White Cliffs itself.
Yes, that's correct. Yes, we are.
So we've got a great load of information coming your way, listeners, as also a fabulous selection of music
as requested by the people we interview.
So what do you reckon, Lynn?
On with the show.
Don't ask any questions, don't snoop around his claim. He'll be out with a dog and a shotgun. Who knows what he's hiding, or why he makes his stand? Men like him are buried alive with opals in their hands. Well, they say he came from Lismore, well, that's about all we know. He came for a weekend only 20 years ago. Well, he must have had money in the bank, for he's found a lot more than potch. For every month he sends a cab for another case of scotch. He's a dreamer, he's a drinker, a bull ant in a hole. He's a schemer, he's a thinker, he's a lonely soul. He's gouging for the opal like a wombat or a mole, way out there at Lightning Ridge. Down below the leopard wood, below the bimble box, get your thrill on Lunatic Hill. Flashes of dancing colour, green and gold and red. Mix it with black and you're on your back, digging until you're dead. Well, it's not about a fancy car, it's not about the cash. They passed the hat for a swimming pool and built it in a flash. No, it's all about the opal, you get it in your eye. See a glimpse of heaven with angels in the sky. And you're a dreamer, you're a drinker, a bull ant in a hole. You're a schemer, you're a thinker, you're a lonely soul. You're gouging for the opal like a wombat or a mole, way out there at Lightning Ridge. Sing with me. He's a dreamer, he's a drinker, a bull ain't in a hole. He's a schemer, he's a thinker, he's a lonely soul. He's gouging for the opal like a wombat or a mole, way out there at Lightning Ridge. Way out there at Lightning Ridge.
So what do you think of that, Lynn?
Yeah, very good.
Johnny Williamson's Lightning Ridge. From his Mulga to Mangoes album. Did you know that was his 11th studio album?
No, I did not.
Did you know it was released in August of 1994?
No, I did not know that either.
And it peaked at number 14 on the ARIA charts and was certified gold.
Wow. Well, there you go.
There you go, indeed. Well, we're not talking about gold, listeners. We're talking about opals. Yes. And the town of White Cliffs.
Now, White Cliffs is a small town in outback New South Wales. White Cliffs is around 255 kilometres northeast of Broken Hill and 93 kilometres north of Wilcannia. Now, it has a population of around 148.
Not a lot of people, Lynn, 148.
No, not many.
Not really. A lot of dust and flies. There'd be a lot more flies there than people.
Probably more goats and emus as well.
Crikey. Now, the town was established in the late 19th century when opal was discovered. Now, opal has been mined ever since. The first Australian opal was found 20 years before in Queensland in 1872 when a party of kangaroo hunters were operating in the White Cliffs area. One of them, who had left the party to track down a wounded kangaroo over some low, stony hills, picked up a pretty shiny stone which appealed to him. When taking back the stone, they suspected it could be opal, with a local jeweller confirming it. He advised them to get as much opal as possible since this could be more profitable than kangaroo hunting. Now, when the group filed their claim, opal had not yet been listed under gemstones and it was decided to file the claim under the Gold Mining Act.
Interesting. Now, many of the residents live underground, using mining equipment to dig extensive homes in the hillside to avoid the intense heat outside. There are also two underground motels in the town, and it's becoming more dependent on tourism.
Absolutely. Fabulous place. There's a place there which we're going to have on next week's program called The Dugout.
Yes, I know. Okay. They are amazing.
That is the most amazing place, listeners, okay? Yeah. The Dugout. So let me tell you a little bit more about White Cliffs. Now, White Cliffs is the site of Australia's first solar power station.
Yeah, interesting.
Absolutely. The White Cliffs Solar Station was built back in 1981, producing 25 kilowatts. And upgraded in 1996 to produce 45. Now, we're using the same collector dishes, but with much better technology.
Yeah, now it just sits there as a white elephant.
It's a white elephant in White Cliffs. Yes. Now, Lynn, I think it's about time you get on to chatting with Dick Wagner from
Southern Cross Opals.
Hello, this is Lynn and we're Roman Oz, and today we are at White Cliffs and we're chatting to Dick at the Southern Cross Opals. How are you today, Dick?
Oh, any day in White Cliffs is wonderful.
Oh, it's a beautiful day. The sun's shining, the sky's blue.
I've even had some Victorians in my shop today.
Yes.
Saying how, oh, it's a bit warm. Cut it out. It's only 28, 29 degrees.
Well, yeah, Victorians would be like that. Sorry, Victorians. So, Dick, how long have you been here in White Cliffs?
Okay, so I've been full-time for 22 years.
Yeah.
That's mining. I pegged a claim back in 2000.
Right.
And found some opal
and
basically went back, quit my job and said, sorry, boss, I'm becoming an opal miner. And
everyone said,
you're crazy, and I think they're spot on.
Yep. So the wife was quite happy to move here?
It's all the wife's fault. She was the one back in 1985. We're originally from Bensdale down in East Gippsland, on the Gippsland Lakes down there. And sitting on the beach one day having a quiet drink, and the wife said, want to go somewhere different for holiday and want to go and find an opal.
Right.
So I had a look around, and there was Lightning Ridge or Cooper Pedy. It was all the opal fields that I knew.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, righto. Well, Lightning Ridge was a bit closer. And then I got talking to my mum, lived in Warrigal, and mum said, go to Whitecliff, she'll love it up there.
Yep.
Found on a map and said, yep, we can do that. So us and the four kids bundled into the car and borrowed a 6x4 trailer off a mate.
Yep.
And bought all our camping gear, and we came to Whitecliffs in 1985, driving home in the car, and the kids said, oh, Dad, that was great fun. Can we do it again next holiday? So for many years it was the cooler months holidays were in Whitecliffs, and the summer months we spent on the beach down in, out from Bensdale.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. So the best of both worlds, and then you moved here.
Yes, in 2000, in 1991 we bought the underground house to dug out. That was our holiday home.
Yep.
But in 2000 I went out in the field and got a hand, one of the old miners from here, asked him the question. I said, was there somewhere that you'd mined that you thought there was opal that you couldn't find?
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, there was one place. So anyway, he took me out there and we re-pegged this old claim that he'd worked back in the 80s. And I did all the paperwork, sent it into the mines department. It came back and we were back later on in the year.
Yep.
And I just said to the wife one day, I'm taking the generator and the jackhammer and the leads and lights and ladders and everything out to the mine. Can you bring me out some lunch, please? And, okay, all right. So she fronted out with some lunch and I'm sitting up on the surface. Everything's turned off, nice and quiet. And she just said, hey, what's going on here? And I said, have a look in the bucket.
Oh.
And old Joe, the guy that had mined it back in the 80s, he'd stopped about 4 inches
from
where the opal seam started. And I basically was on opal for the best part of every day for 3 years.
Wow.
Ended up with bucketfuls out of it. Some absolutely brilliant stuff.
Yep.
Graded down to some stuff that was just average, but, a bit of everything. And, the wife, my wife, my daughter and my granddaughter came up to visit one day and my daughter said, well, come on, show us some of this opal you've been spruiking about. So I just had a square of shade cloth I tipped out in the ground and out 2 20-litre buckets of opal.
Oh.
And my daughter just went, oh, gee, look at all this, you know. And then she stopped and she said, oh, Dad, who's seen all this? And I just pointed to my wife, my daughter, my granddaughter and myself. And I said, us, that small group, you know.
Yep.
So at that stage, I was a kept man. My wife was working and I was just up here enjoying.
Oh, so she was working back in Victoria. Yes, okay.
So she was still working and any guys out there thinking of, you know, if you could handle that sort of thing, I can 100% recommend it.
What's brilliant. That? The opal wife, mining or the wife being away?
The whole box of dice, yes. It's you couldn't do any better.
But she's
better.
Here now, though.
No, no. She was here up until a few weeks ago, but it's gone back down south.
Oh, okay, to see the grandkids and everything.
Yeah. So, and grandson's wedding and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, but she gets the blame for it all. But, we found all this opal, and what are we going to do with it? So, at that stage, I was just a full-time miner.
Yeah.
I was having fun, you know, it was great. So
you've got it all hidden, but you didn't know what to do with it.
Didn't know what to do with it. Yeah, anyway, so we sat down to talk about it for a few days and decided we'd put a bit of gold and silver out it, open a shop, and that was 2003.
Yep.
So now my day consists of basically I mine from 7 o'clock in the morning to 9. I come back and have a quick shower and shave and brekkie and run the shop from 9 to 5.
Right.
Do that 6 days a week.
Yep.
I get a bit of time off on Sunday.
Yes.
I go and play golf for a couple of hours on Sunday
morning. Oh, so there's a golf course here?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. I thought it would be a bit rocky. So is it grass or is it?
There, come. Grass. Have you seen much grass? And this is a pretty good year we're having now.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Oh, you've had a bit of rain.
We've had a bit of rain, yes, yeah. Right. But, there's grass on the golf course, no.
No, okay. No. So it's a bit rocky.
It is. It can be a bit rocky.
Oh,
yes.
Okay. And so in your shop, so do you send your opal to jewellers or?
No. I have a caster in Adelaide who makes us all the blank settings.
Mm-hmm.
And my son now does a lot of the work. I do get some work done in Adelaide with a professional guy down there.
Yep.
Mainly the inlay work. It's just something that he's very, very good at.
Yep.
So with that, my son now has taken over the mantle to do most of the rest of the work. So.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's good. So it's a real family business.
Yep.
So, Dick, where do you mine the opals? Is it close to town or is it a fair way out? Or?
Well, the Whitecliffs opal field covers about 1,200 acres. And I suppose you'd call it just about in the middle of it.
Oh, right.
And from here, it's only probably a bit over a kilometre.
It's not far
at all.
Oh, okay.
So it's a very, very condensed field. And, you know, there's a few things special about White Cliffs.
Mm.
One of them is it's the only place where we have this, what they call a double pseudomorph, which is a White Cliffs pineapple, which started off life as a cluster of crystals, three different sorts, as Eichite, Glauberite and Glendonite crystals. The crystal grew that structure, and when the opal process happened, the opals come along, dissolve the crystal out and just fill them up with pure opal.
Mm, okay.
Some are common opal or what we call poch. It's back in, they were formed back in the Ice Age when this was all part of the inland sea.
Yep, yep.
Glaciers here even before that, because we do get rocks that have been transported here on a glacier from Cobar, quartzite, which don't normally naturally occur around here.
Right.
So they've either skated here with a glacier and deposited, or chunks broken off as an iceberg and floated here and deposited the rock here. So
did you have any knowledge about opals before you came here, or did you learn it all and did a bit of research and everything?
Started 22 years ago knowing nothing.
No.
And I've still got it all. So, look, it's all just hit and miss.
Yep.
You learn as you go, that sort of thing.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was just a case of initial early days back at home in the shed. We had the cutting and polishing gear back there.
Yep.
So you go out the shed of a night, and the first lesson I learnt was don't practice on good opal.
Yes.
Practice on rubbish.
Yes.
Because
otherwise, you've just lost a lot of money.
Just lost it all, yes. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, just one of those things. It's all practice. Fortunately now my son's come on board. Rusty's been on board for about 10 years
so
now.
He has learned how to cut and polish and everything.
Younger
else.
Eyes, nimbler fingers, all that sort of stuff. He can. He's now taken over to do a lot of the cutting and the polishing for us.
Okay.
One of the other things that White Cliffs is pretty famous for is we refer to ourselves as the first and the friendliest.
Yep.
We're the first opal field by 20 years, and we're also the friendliest. Opal fields aren't renowned for being friendly.
Right.
But White Cliffs, we pride ourselves on being friendly. And with that, one of the things we offer is for people to go and noodle, fossicle noodle out in the dumps, what the old miners did.
Oh, okay, back, see if they can strike it lucky.
Yeah, just pick up a couple of bits. What the old miner, you've got to remember, the old miner mined with a candle.
Mm-hmm.
And even in some situations, if they're having a bit of a bad run, they would dig in the dark and actually listen for the sound of the pick hitting glass versus the rock. So so it is possible they missed some of it.
Yeah.
And one of the services we offer here is if people pick up a bit of opal out in the field, bring it in here.
Yep.
We won't work on it for them. We will show you what to do,
let
you use our gear in the workshop.
Right.
And you can bring the bit of opal in that you've found. If it's rubbish, no, we're not going to waste your time, our time on it. But if it's something that's worthwhile, and only in the last few days I've had a girl picked up quite a very, very pretty piece, a lovely bit of crystal, crystal opal is what White Cliffs is renowned for. We made that put it on a dob stick for her. A dob stick is when you have a small piece of opal so that you can hold it, so you don't have to hold it in your fingers.
Right.
Cleaned it up, polished it up. I've got some different sort of rings in there. We found a ring that suited.
Oh, lovely.
Claw set it in, glued it in as well.
Yep.
And about 40 minutes later, she walked out with this ring on her finger,
the
bit
beautiful
of opal that
souvenir.
She'd found. She'd polished, cut and polished, shaped it, all that sort of thing. I made her glue it in because you've got to hold it for about 10 minutes while the glue sets.
Yep.
I wasn't going to do that. So, just with that, she walked out and out in the sunshine, it was a lovely stone. And I said,
lovely.
Look, that ring's worth $250, $300.
Wow. You know,
just
there
a bit of something that she'd picked up in the field. My next door neighbour, he's new to White Cliffs and opaling. He picked a piece up the other day. And again, I took him into the workshop and showed him what to do. And after about 20 minutes, because what happens, we have different grits of wheels.
Right,
and the coarser grit is your shaping, but it can also put scratches in it. So you get off that wheel onto a slightly finer wheel and then a finer wheel and a finer wheel. And by the time you get to the fine wheel, it's like watching paint dry or grass grow sort of thing. And he showed me the stone after about 20 minutes or so, and I said, you're nearly there, you know. It took him probably another 20 minutes on the polishing wheel. And he polished it down, and I said, listen, mate, that's an $800 stone.
In wow. England,
you know, just picked it up out in the field.
Wow.
We do get a lot of bits and pieces out there that are crazed because they've been on the surface in the weather conditions out yes. here for over 100 years. So.
Yep.
But, yeah, and pretty much every week we have people. We had son Rusty took some people in there yesterday to the cutting room yesterday. They had a couple of pieces. We cleaned them up and they weren't going to amount to anything. Yep. So you only go so far with them.
Mm-hmm.
You sort of can't make strawberry jam out of pig manure. So yeah. you just got to draw the line somewhere. And go, yep, righto, that's as good as we're going to get with that piece. So,
Okay. Oh, that sounds interesting. So we're going to take a break now. Now, Dick, have you got a song that we can play for you?
Anything from Graham Connors.
Yep.
Just a little further north.
That would do all right, and we'll come back with more of Dick and Southern Cross Opals after that song.
The sun sinks behind me in the west. This is the time of day I love best. Salt breezes murmur through the coconut palm. As the colors change, they set a scene of tropic calm. Seagulls heading back to land. Over the mangroves and the soap pans, by a lazy creek with a six pack and a fishing line, win back some memories and losing track of time. I head a little further north each year, leave the cities behind. Out of sight, out of mind. Whoa, where my troubles all disappear. I head a little further north each year. Feeling the night wrapped around me. Eases my mind in serenity. Ocean waves are humming on the outer reef. These balmy nights and sultry days are a welcome relief. I head a little further north each year. Leave the cities behind. Out of sight, out of mind. Whoa, up when my troubles all disappear. I head a little further north each year. I head a little further north each year. Taking my mind.
Okay, welcome back, listeners. We're with Dick at Southern Cross Opals. Now, there was a question I wanted to ask you. You keep saying the word. What is poch?
Poch. Okay, so there's two different sorts of opal. We have common opal, which is basically poch, which mm-hmm. is created as opal, but we don't get any of the actual sparkly colours out of it. Right, okay. That's what we call common opal, or you've got precious opal, which is what we put into our jewellery. Got all the sparkles and the lovely colours in it, every colour of the rainbow.
Lovely. All right. Oh, okay. Now, also, too, you were mentioning earlier before we went on air about a children's cemetery.
Yeah, okay. There's two our main cemeteries out here to the east, mm-hmm. and that's very, very... it's sad, but it's one of those historic places that you have to go to. They think, they're not sure, but mm-hmm. there could be up to 500 kids buried out there.
Oh, wow.
It was tragic. You know, you got to remember back in the 1890s, yes. When, you know, this was in its heyday, we had the Federation drought, which mm-hmm. ran from the early 1890s to about 1903 or 4 or something like that before it broke. So there would have been a definite shortage of water, and if they ever did get any water, they talked about the fever, typhoid,
yes.
With the bad water. So there's also a little heritage graves up behind the caravan park and heritage park up there, and you take your mind back 130 odd years ago when there was a tent there with the mum and three or four, five kids.
Yep.
Living there, and one of them got the fever, so a few days later the poor kid died. So they've gone out and they've just dug a shallow grave and put a ring of rocks around it, yep. that sort of thing. There's five rings around, and you could just imagine you stand
children.
There and you look back there and you think, yeah, well, all the kids
yep.
got this fever and died. Very, very sad, very tragic, but they weren't stuck here. They nearly were.
Yeah.
You know, they were carting water in from Will Canyon with bullock teams.
That'd take certainly a while because that's like 100 kilometres.
Yep. And back in those days, you would have had to leave a certain amount of water in the barrel to be able to water the bullock teams to get them back to Will Canyon to bring us more water out.
Yep.
I don't know whether the river was flowing then or whether it had actually dried up and they were using bore water.
Right.
But... yeah, it was very, very tragic times back then. But there was riches to be made here, so people, you know, just persevered with it. Yeah.
Oh, okay. And any other historical things that you can tell us about the area?
Look, there's we've now got a history group here.
Oh, okay.
And there's a lot of history in the whole area. Yep. You know, like where did Whitecliffs get its name from?
Yes.
And there's a few different stories. Originally, it was called Yankania. But one of the stories, and the one that's sort of my favourite, is that when they walked into Whitecliffs, basically they were gold prospectors or gold miners,
mm-hmm.
and they'd caught the paddle steamer out of Victoria. They caught the paddle steamer up to Wilcannia. If they were really lucky, they had a wheelbarrow with
yep.
all their worldly possessions mm-hmm. on board. So they just headed off for Whitecliffs. Well, Whitecliffs was on the way to Milparinca, where the next gold find was.
Right.
So on their way past Whitecliffs, the signpost said Whitecliffs, so many kilometres. So some of them realised that they could come in here and start digging. That's one of the things that they knew how to do.
Yes.
And find some riches. Or obviously some kept going to Wilcannia. But when you came in over what we call these Carrara Hills out to the south, because the initial find of opal was on this Turley's Hill, and the opal was created underwater years ago when this was all part of the Eromanga Sea.
Yep.
So the water's gone back into the polar caps, back to the South Pole, North Pole, and eventually, just through weathering over absolutely millions and millions of years, the dirt's washed away, the seabed, and just left the opal exposed there. So that's how they first found it. So they saw it disappearing into the hill and they could just trench into the hill and find it. But they tipped their spoil over the hill.
Yep.
And eventually they got enough spoil over the hill that when you walked in over on those Carrara Hills over there, it looked white.
Right.
And it reminded them of the White Cliffs of Dover. So that's one story.
Yep.
Another one is that when you go out to the west and you look back here, there's a white mirage looking into the... And we have postcards of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but... As most people probably came in from the south and not the west, it's probably more likely that it was just what they could see, the white spoil that was tipped out of the mine. So.
Oh, interesting. And Turley's Hill, is that obviously named after somebody?
Yeah, Wollaston Turley was one of the original opal finders here. There was six in the original party. They were out culling roos and saw this pretty stone on the ground. Didn't know what it was. Picked up a few bags of it. And eventually, it was quite a while later, you know, years later, that they actually got to Adelaide. And one of them knew a geologist. So they took it to the geologist. And the story goes, he had £150 in the bank. Now, in 1888, that would have bought you half a dozen houses.
Yeah,
a lot of
money. That's a lot of money.
And he thought, I'm not going to give it all to him. So he offered him £140 for the parcel. Mm. So, of course, they were just gobsmacked. They just thought, you know, this just can't happen. Mm. Anyway, so they... they grabbed the money and decided to come back. And in those days, your lease was 40 acres. Mm. And they had the tribute system here where the miners came in and worked. They were given a 10-foot by 10-foot plot.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, that's why there's so many holes so close together out there in the field. They had a pick and a shovel. So they could. They didn't have ladders. So in a lot of those holes out there, you can still see the toe holes of how they climbed in and out.
Oh, really?
A lot of money went down to about 13 or 14 feet, about 4 metres in New Day money, because that was as far down as they could pick up a shovel full of spoil and throw it out the hole. So eventually they got ropes and buckets and windlasses and that sort of stuff. But ladders, you know, sort of hardly even heard of, and especially trying to get a ladder to Whitecliffe would be...
where would you get one from? You know, your local Bunnings isn't around here anywhere.
Most certainly not. So, look, and yeah, there's a few very interesting things with Whitecliffs. It was the first commercial opal field, and we call ourselves the first and the friendliest.
Yeah.
Not all opal fields, we don't think they're quite as friendly as Whitecliffs, and you've only got to be here for, you know, a few hours, and you'll meet some wonderful people.
Yes.
And they're just ever so friendly. And as you've experienced this morning, going into Lindsay and Cree's home and being absolutely gobsmacked with that.
Yes.
I explained to people, yep, come into my shop and buy a bit of jewellery. But the thing you're going to remember about Whitecliffs is going into that Lindsay and Cree's house.
Yes.
Just, he puts us all to shame. You know, 75-year-old and working like a bloody 20-year-old. So, but, a couple of things with Whitecliffs. What we find here is crystal opal, and crystal opal has a clear background. Now, every opal field has access to every colour of the rainbow and every derivative of every colour of the rainbow. And the reason you see colour in a rainbow is exactly the same reason you see colour in opal. These silica spheres we talk about, the way they stack up is what diffracts the colour out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at the end of the day, it's all hard work and luck is opal mining.
Yep, yep.
You can't go out today and say, yep, I'm going to bring back some blue or some green or whatever. So,
Oh, wonderful. All right. Well, I think we better wrap it up there, Dick. We've spent enough time, you know, chewing your ear and finding out all these little things about Whitecliffs. So can we play another song for you? And we do know that Graham Connors is your favourite singer. So what say we play...
If anyone's ever been to a Graham Connors concert, he always leaves the best to last.
Yes, and that is...
The Ringer and the Princess.
Oh, okay. All right then, we'll play that for you. The Ringer and the Princess. Thank you, Dick.
And thank you.
We'll be back with more Roman Isles straight after Graham Connors' Ringer and the Princess.
Everybody called him Dingo. He didn't seem to mind the name. Aboriginal and Asian blood ran 50-50 in his veins. With skin like saddle leather, an inscrutable kind of smile, beneath the brim of his akubra, he had the dreaming in his eyes. She had a bloodline back to Europe, the boss's daughter, Marianne. Home for Christmas at the station, from a boarding school in Cairns. With such a perfect face and figure, boys would blush when she walked by. Behind her back they called her princess, 'cause 'cause she had the distance in her eyes. Oh, the ringer and the princess, the dingo and the deer. I'll tell you their story if you want to hear. December rain fell with a vengeance from a cyclone in the Gulf. Bone-dried gullies turned to rivers, and plains became a sea of mud. So the boss brought everyone together, the family and the station hands, to open gates and knock down fences and give the stock a fighting chance. Well, the princess, she was out there riding right alongside the men, leading horses up to safety, trying to bring the stragglers in, till she heard a wild commotion a little further down the way. A mare was trying to cross a gully, and its foal was being washed away. Now the young have always been impulsive. The princess had no second thoughts. She rode her mount into that gully, trying to save the drowning horse. But in the midst of the raging waters, her pony lost its step and fell, with her foot caught in the stirrup, the princess disappeared as well. Dingo saw the whole thing happen, like a man possessed, he rode straight into that swollen gully, about 100 yards below. And by the time the others got there, all hope of finding her was gone, till Dingo staggered from the water with the princess in his arms. Oh, the ringer and the princess, the dingo and the deer. I'll tell you their story if you want to hear. Now the princess owns the station, her dad, the boss, has long since died. And although she never married, Dingo's always by her side. And still the gossips talk about them, even after all these years, about the ringer and the princess, dingo and the deer, about the ringer and the princess, the dingo and the deer.
Hello listeners, Phil C here from Roaming Oz. Now I'm going to be talking with Peter again, Peter Keirath. He's the chairman of the Narromine Aviation Museum. You might recall he was on the program last week
and so much wonderful information, we decided to do another call in here. And we're going to chat with him again. How are you today, Peter?
Again, I'm still here, mate. It was my birthday yesterday.
It was. You're still standing. And how young are you?
83
years young, listeners, okay? And he looks fabulous, and he's a wealth of knowledge. So what are you going to tell us about this week, Peter?
Well, I just thought we could start with the elementary flying training school. Okay. Again, just it was very important. Mm-hmm. Probably the biggest elementary flying training school in Australia. There were 12 altogether.
Right.
The first four were in Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide and Brisbane, and then Narromine.
Okay.
So it was set up in May, or it opened in May of 1940, and they trained 2,850 pilots here. Mm-hmm. They were here for 4 years, and as I mentioned earlier, we've been through all their records and so on, and hopefully we're going to get that up on a TV screen when we can get somebody that can handle that sort of technology.
Right.
But 618 Squadron here was very important. It was a top secret squadron.
Yes.
So all the pilots and navigators and staff were specially selected in England. It was set up to attack the Tirpitz, which was in a fjord in southern Norway. The problem they had... Yeah, most people will remember 617 Squadron, the Dam Busters.
Yes, I remember that.
Now, 618 Squadron was set up to do the similar thing, the bouncing bombs,
yes,
but to attack the Tirpitz, which was in a fjord in Norway. The Lancasters couldn't get at it.
Okay.
And so Barnes Wallace said, well, look, that's okay. We'll get the Mosquitoes to do that. Mm-hmm. The problem is the Mosquitoes were doing 120 miles an hour faster.
Right.
Than the Lancasters,
okay,
which meant that the Storr, when it hit the water, was doing 350 miles an hour,
well, okay,
which was like dropping the Storr on concrete.
Wow, okay.
And so it took them several months, 10 months probably, to really resolve that problem.
Mm-hmm.
But by then the Germans had moved the battleship up to northern Norway to interfere with the North Sea fleets that were going to Murmansk, and that was out of the range of the Mosquitoes.
Okay.
And it was subsequently 617 Squadron, okay, solved that problem.
Yes.
So they put the Mosquitoes on two aircraft carriers, the Fencer and the Striker. They sent them out to Fisherman's Bend in Melbourne, serviced them and flew them straight to Narromine.
Okay.
And here they were flying at low altitudes, 400 miles an hour at 60 feet. I've had a lot of the old local blokes used to tell me that often the Mosquitoes would come back in and they'd have leaves in their radiators and things like that. So you think, ooh.
Getting pretty close to the ground.
My word.
Yes.
But I think what they were doing was getting used to the atmospheric conditions here, which were quite different to in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
But then, as I mentioned, the Americans dropped the atomic bombs in early August and all bets were off. They wound the squadron up in September. All the fellows went back to England and, as I mentioned, they had the sale in... Well, they offered them to the Australian government, but the Australian government said, no, well... We're into jet aircraft, vampires, meteors and that sort of thing. We're not taking a wooden frame plane, so thank you very much.
Okay.
So, as I mentioned, they sold them off £75 and everything in those days was rationed. I mean, like fuel, clothing, all sorts of food. Couldn't buy any nuts and bolts or anything of that nature, so... If you got a piece of equipment with all that stuff on it, or a lot of stuff on it, certainly that's the reason the farmers bought them.
That's right.
And but, as I mentioned, they also had 250 gallons of fuel in them.
Fuel, as we mentioned
and
last week.
So that was a big thing. So, but anyway, so that was just a little bit of a story on 618 Squadron. As I mentioned, they were all sworn under the Official Secrets Act, the penalty of which could have been death if they talked about... So nobody in the town really knew what they were doing. They'd go in and have a few beers and, you know, they'd be questioned, and but they'd just change the subject. So that's just an interesting little story. This is quite an interesting story here too. We had a chap ring me from Tamworth and said he had this stained glass piece that had come out of a hotel in Mascot. And they, in 1988, they pulled this hotel down.
Okay.
And this was at the back of the
hotel,
in the main bar. And he said to the boss, "What are you going to do with that?" And he said, "Oh, well, we'll put it out the tip." And he said, "No, I'll come in on the weekend and pull it down." And he kept it for 30-odd years.
Wow.
And then, for some reason, rang me to see if we wanted it. And
yes.
I said, well, we'd be interested, because what happened was that Howard Bowden Fletcher, a local bloke, Amy Johnson was the first woman to fly between England and Australia, and landed in Darwin in 1930.
Mm-hmm.
And Howard Bowden Fletcher sent her a telegram inviting her to call in at Narromine on the way to Sydney.
Okay.
And anyway, she said, yes, well, that's, I can do that. But she crashed the plane in Brisbane and put it all off. But nevertheless, they made her the first life member of the Narromine Aero Club.
Okay.
And so, yes.
So this lead light window, that's her and her plane.
That's right. That's right. And so, anyway, we thought, oh, well, I'd say we had to get it restored, all the frame and so on has been restored, and then we had this nice Australian redwood frame, so it cost us a lot of money, the lighting and so on, but it's come up
fabulous.
Very well. And there was a little bit of a dark corner, so it was an ideal place to put it, really.
Absolutely.
So,
fabulous.
So, yes, although she had a bit of a catastrophic end in London, but we need to go into that.
Yes.
So, so that was that. We've got the Aero Club display here. That is all new.
Okay.
We have the pre-war section and the post-war section.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that display's come up really well, as I mentioned. The Narromine Aero Club was set up in September of 1929,
mm-hmm.
and still there. So we think, again, that it's probably one of the oldest, if not the oldest, in regional Australia. I mean, Point Cook and Royal Newcastle and a few are just a bit older, but we think in this area... I'll just flip that. Yes, anyway, so we've got these timelines here. This is the post-war timeline.
Right.
And that gives, we go through each year and just put what happened. We've got we've got the pre-war one and the wartime one.
Okay.
So people can just read there and see exactly what went on during that post-war
era. Post-World War II, yes.
Yeah. So this is the old beacon. That was out here, and it is an international beacon. It does go round, and it's blue and white, which indicates that it was an international beacon, because this was the alternate to Mascot for many years.
Okay.
So. And it was on the tower out there, so now we've had a little tower and put it in here. So, and then we've got just a little display on the right flyer. This is the model that the Sydney University Aeronautical Group made that first.
Yes.
And then they proved that the design was right. They had a battery and an electric motor in it. And it flew well, so then they went on and designed this based on that. So, because when Eric Hayden was trying to get plans for it, he was in touch with the US, and really is all they had is a few sketches like that, which I think it was very much monkey see, monkey do.
Yes, okay.
And so then we have a little section here on the gliding with the big banner of the World Junior Championships that were in 1915, I mentioned earlier. We have the World Open Gliding Championships here next year.
Okay.
So we'll probably get quite a few out here this year because, again, they like to practice in these conditions.
Fabulous.
I was talking to a couple of the young Dutch blokes when they were out here in 15. We had there was a do in town for them, and I said, how have you found the conditions here? And they said, ooh, I've never seen anything like this. And I said, well, what do you get in Denmark? And they said, oh, we could get up to 5,000 or 6,000 feet, and you can see probably 8 or 9 kilometres. And I said, well, what do you get out here? And he said, today we're up to 16,000 feet.
Oh, wow.
And we can see 135 kilometres.
So, double the distance and 10 times the view.
Well, it was about 3 years ago. We had I think eight fellows. No, go away. We had eight fellows do over 1,000 kilometres in a day in a glider,
right.
And one fellow did 1,120 in a day in
okay.
a glider.
Wow.
No power.
Just relying
on the thermals.
Gliding on the thermals.
So. Then we've got a little workshop here. We had all this material in our hut, and it was taking up a lot of room and so on and so forth. And so we decided to build a little workshop out here and just move all the stuff into that. So, and we take bits and pieces out of it occasionally and put in.
Okay.
And this is a MiG 15 engine. We had a chap here. Many years ago, who had a MiG 15. I think he got it from Poland and you could go for a trip in it if you were game.
Okay.
They used to burn a lot of fuel, I think 3,000 litres an hour, so to go up for 40 minutes was about $1,800. So,
okay.
And then we've got another Rolls Royce Merlin engine there.
Mm-hmm.
And. It's we have two of those, and this one is more complete. It's still got the mounts and all that sort of thing on it, but it's got the four-bladed prop on it.
Okay.
And that is very, very rare for
okay.
a Mosquito. So, and then this is just the undercarriage of a Mosquito there. So, and these are interesting old things. We had quite a few of these around here. They were put in during the war. The council started to pull them out, and I said, what are you going to do with those, the fire hydrants?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, oh, tip. And I said, no, museum.
Okay.
So we had them re-powder coated and cleaned up, and the chap did some work on it. History, they were built in Melbourne between 1920 and 1929.
Right.
But they were made for Victoria, the ACT and the military. And so that's so we have two of those here, and they're really, really come up quite well. So we have the big screen there, where you can see the Wright Flyer flying. We are just having a little bit of trouble with the projector at the moment, but we're going to replace that, and that'll bring it all back up to new. So you just have to touch the screen there that,
okay.
And it will come up showing you the Wright Flyer flying.
Oh,
that's
okay.
This plane here.
Yes.
So, but as I say, we'll do a lot better than that. We're getting a new laser projector up there, so hopefully we'll get that up in the next few weeks. So, yeah.
Fabulous stuff.
So just the other thing over here is that we have descriptions of all the, or some of the most famous blokes that have been here, like Henry Wigley, like Alan Cobham, Francis Chichester, first bloke to sail around the world, Ross Smith and the crew, Charles Kingsford Smith, Col Pay, Ingo Renner, all these people have been to Narromine. And so we've got a little description there, some photos and just what they've what they were here for. We've got Chuck Yeager just around here, Buzz Aldrin, should I say, around here. Chuck Yeager was here, and he's the first bloke to break the sound barrier in the world. I think he did it in the US in 1947, so came out to Narromine.
You've had some very famous people out here.
Yes, indeed.
So who'd be the most famous? I guess Buzz.
Yes, well, without a doubt, Buzz Aldrin. It'd have to be him, although fair dinkum, a lot of those other blokes are pretty well
known in their own field, of course.
Definitely, yeah. And of course they're much earlier than him.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
I mean, some of them are out here in the 20s and 30s. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, all right.
Anyway.
Well, yeah. I think we've just about covered it, and it's a very quick overview.
Yes.
So for anybody who is interested in aviation, definitely they should call into the museum.
Well, yeah, yes, I think we'd welcome them here. It's good to get plenty of people through. The more we can get through, we have quite a few other things to do.
Mm-hmm.
We want to put a memorial wall out the front with all the 2,850 names on it, with a cross for the ones that didn't come back.
Didn't return, yeah.
So that's quite a big project, which I think this is... It's a very important project. It'll be the only one in the 12 elementary flying trains that would have a memorial wall like that. So then, hopefully, next week or two, we'll get the Jabiroo up, and but you get three or four jobs done, and another six or eight jump up.
Yes. But you're going to get there, I can tell. So, look, Peter, 83 years young, you're going to get that done.
Yeah.
You're going to get all these things done before you're ready to soar amongst the clouds.
Yes, well, you've got to be persistent. That's the problem.
Okay.
Quality, it's got to be good quality.
Yep.
And that, if it needs to be done, you've got to do it.
All right. Well, we're going to now wind this one up, my friend. If anything else comes up, though, in the future, please get in touch with me.
Yeah.
All right, Peter, well, we're going to wind this up. Right, Peter Kirath, listeners, he's the chairman of the Narromine Aviation Museum. I'm going to play you another song, Waltzing Matilda. So, thank you so much for your time,
that's
Peter.
A pleasure, right. Pleasure.
All right, listeners, we'll be back with more Roaming Oz straight after this.
You'll come along, sing Matilda with me. You'll come along, sing Matilda with me.
We hope you enjoyed the show, listeners.
If you missed any, check out our Facebook page or allaussieradio.com.au.
Tune in next week for more Roman Oz.